supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Distress, distress, has many forms and feels quite different for each of us. Maybe it shows up in you as anxiety, fear, panic, or some type of illness, an ache inside your very being. Ultimately, what are we looking for when we're in this kind of distress? And more important, where do we look? Some of us find comfort in a couple of glasses of wine at the end of the day, or a bag of chips or other carbs. Sometimes tears help us distress, or running to the arms of a lover or almost anyone. My guest today says that those are not always available, and they might not be the answer. Tara Brach said that when we're afraid or overwhelmed, it's easy to turn to external things for comfort. But in her new book, True Refuge, she explores the pathway that carry us to an inner sanctuary that's always there for us, and it's always been there. Tara Brach joins us on the phone to talk about her book. It's a collection of teachings and guided meditations, narratives of those who look within for wisdom. It's really a book about self-soothing, in a way. Tara, welcome back to Voices.
Oh, Dan, it's a pleasure to be with you and with your listeners. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. Tara's a leading Western teacher of Buddhist meditation, emotional healing, and really awakening. She's practiced and taught for over 35 years. She's a senior teacher and founder of the Insight Meditation Community of Washington. We'd love to hear from you about this important and interesting topic. Let us know if you know when you're seeking refuge and what refuge means to you. Where do you look for it when you got that ache or fear inside? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Tara, I'm always intrigued by how people got to where they are today. So your undergraduate degree was in political science, and then you spent the next 10 years in ashrams. Is this typical for people from Montclair, New Jersey? Is it a Montclair thing?
I hadn't quite anchored it into geography, but I know a lot of people that went the route I went to, which was having a real care and passion about the world and getting involved politically, and then in some way coming to that sense that the change, Gandhi put it, the change we seek is who we are, is that really need to start with consciousness. And ultimately, it's not either or. We need to be active in our world and be waking up our hearts and minds. So I did that route of I was very, very involved politically and then started realizing I needed to get to know this mind right here and open my heart some.
It does say something about you that you're able, willing to leave this roadmap, this path that you and most everyone else was on. That's really a leap of faith, isn't it?
It's a leap of faith in some ways, but it kind of arose organically, Dan. I you know, in the midst of political activity, I was doing a lot of yoga, and yoga got me in touch with my body and in touch with blocks and in touch with a yearning. It kind of showed me where I was a bit in a trance. And I started noticing, and I wasn't alone in this. I was not the only pioneer there. It was kind of like a lot of us started realizing that as much as we valued the goals of left-wing politics, there was a lot of strident shaking the fists at, you know, those that were bad and creating an other that was in some way less than or evil or whatever. And it started becoming clear that it really, that the change that we wanted was going to come more from a place of compassion and understanding. So I think a lot of us kind of turned towards, well, let's go to the consciousness direction.
Ultimately, Tara, you know, your point is that true refuge is something inside of us, something that we've had all our lives. So I wonder if it's in there, you know, why do we need someone else to help us find it? There was a great Jackie Mason monologue from years ago where he says, I went to see a psychiatrist the other day, and I said, what are we going to do? And he says, well, the psychiatrist told me we're going to help you find your unconscious. And Jackie Mason said, so I said to him, well, it's my unconscious. Wouldn't I know where to look first before you would? And what if I find it and I don't like what I found? Or what if I find it and find I'm already a psychiatrist? And do I charge you? I don't know how this works. But you know,
I love it. Yeah, it's, well, the Buddhists have a, you know, we have some Buddhist personals out there, and one of them is tall, dark, handsome Buddhist looking for himself. You know? Same idea. It's like, what are we looking for, outside or inside? And it's really, it's a false distinction in a way, because it's just as important that you and I find our place of resonance and care and connection as it is that I find that within my own being, towards my own life. It's not really separate. It's, I think the point of, and the reason I wrote this book, is that we need to have the capacity to draw on what's within us. We'll never really feel safe and at ease on the planet if we don't realize that that loving that we experience with others dwells inside us. So it's not an either or, because to not live it with each other would be to really cut off our life energy. So it's really a training in how do you look within yourself and discover those capacities.
I would argue with you that those who believe in an all-powerful, all-loving external God also find true refuge in that relationship.
I agree with that, because I think that relationship is they can experience it within their being. I think the confusion of words is really inside and outside. It's mm-hmm. It's really the inquiry of, can you in this moment feel the experience of loving presence? And it doesn't matter whether you're imagining that loving presence is arising because of something outside you or something innately inside you. Can you experience loving presence? And there are many, many pathways to it. I mean, when I work with people, for some, it's because we're wounded in relationship, the first gateway to experiencing loving presence is through being reminded of our connection with each other. And that's primary. In other words, I can't say go find it in yourself. They're cut off. So the first way to wake up that loving presence is through what we call a relationship with another person. And for others, it might be with a deity. And then for many people, gradually, there's a sense that, oh, I can sit here by myself and get quiet and feel the life that's in me and regard that with a tenderness. And what I'm suggesting is that to have, that's a maturity that really can carry us through our days when we have that final capacity.
When we look at the nature of our lives, though, it seems we're looking for something very different from refuge. You know, we're racing around trying to either achieve something mythical that really doesn't get explored, or trying to manage a life that's too busy. You know, when we spoke with you earlier, you said that the Chinese word for busyness was heart killing.
I did. Since I said that, I've been told by scholars in Chinese texts that while there's some close relations to it, it's not so exact as I was making it sound, so I'm correcting myself for the record. But I think we know intuitively what that means. When we're busy, or I can speak for myself, when I'm busy, my heart, I'm moving too fast to really be tender or sensitive to myself or the world. So I think there's truth in it. And what I think what you're saying, Dan, is how it is in our society, that we tend to seek our comfort, our pleasure, and our relief by dashing around, by checking things off a list, by accomplishing things, by numbing ourselves with alcohol, our drugs, or whatever it is. And I've used the term false refuge as a way of saying we're trying to make ourselves feel better through these strategies that deliver in a temporary way, as happens with all addiction. We get a temporary fix of feeling in some way soothed or better about ourselves or whatever. But in the long run, they actually lock us in more into having to keep on doing the same, and we never get what I would call a more genuine sense of happiness, of ease, of contentment, of peace. So true refuge is basically the assumption in the book is that...
Well, I think we've had a technical glitch and we've lost Tara for the moment. But if you're just tuning in, we're talking about true refuge, what refuge means, what we ultimately look for. And I would ask you, when you look at your life, how busy it is, what is it you're really after here? What are the long-term goals of your busy life? Is it to achieve something, or is it to avoid disaster? And Tara would argue that perhaps what you're looking for is what she calls refuge and what I would call well-being or safety or security. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. My question to you is, what is your life about? What is it that you want, and what does well-being actually look like? We're going to get Tara back on the line. When we do, she's a clinical psychologist, and her new book is called True Refuge, Finding Peace and Freedom in Your Own Awakened Heart. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about true refuge with a world-renowned teacher and scholar and a dear friend of mine, Tara Brock. Tara, we've got you back?
We've got me back, yeah.
Well, that makes me happy. Tara, I want to share a poem with you that I think really strikes this issue squarely. Let's listen. We have that poem up. I once had a student who was so depressed she wanted to die. She was a young, single mother, lonely, poor, watching other girls go to parties and bars while she was home, cutting the crusts off peanut butter sandwiches and reading the Bernstein Bears in the Bad Dream. Then she collapsed with heart disease and spent the next few years waiting for a transplant. The strange thing is, now she was happy. Almost every day, almost every breath, she was semi-ecstatic. She was a modern-day Chicana Rumi, hanging out with the beloved, grateful just to touch his hem. I find I'm telling myself all the time now, look how you lift one foot and then the other, all the nerves and synapses firing together. Look how you reach for a carton of blueberries and eat each dusky globe one by one. Look at the spotted dog tied to the newsstand, drops of saliva sliding off his tongue, and the cracked Bic lighter in the gutter shining watery turquoise blue. Even when your heart is a used tea bag, you can lie down in a warm bed, even though you cry half the night with the windows open a little to let in the stars. Ellen Bass. Yeah, and the title of that poem is Happiness.
I'd love a copy. It's beautiful.
Well, we'll get you a copy. You've got some pull. You know people here at Voices. And it's also going to be on our website for everybody else who who wants a copy. Let's go to the phones, Tara. We've got several people who want to join the conversation. We've got John on the line. Hey, John.
Hi, Dr. Dan. Thanks for taking the call. It seems to me, in order to achieve tranquility and refuge, I think you have to be able to hear your mother's soothing voice and be able to go to that, you know, to hear or feel your mother's soothing voice, love, attention. And I think that initially gives us a secure base which to operate from. And also then gives us the resilience to work through trauma that happens, you know, throughout our lives. But you have to be able to go back, and it's kind of like a touchstone that even though it's unconscious, you know it's there. You know, it's like a background hum that's always there.
John, I trust that you had a mother with a soothing, loving voice.
Yes.
So, Tara, what about people who aren't as lucky as John?
Well, first, I love what you're bringing in, John, because I think that to the extent that we had a sense of belonging, to keep on calling on that is what gives us the grounds for everything else. And many people had severed belonging, so they didn't have that same nourishment. And yet there's something in this loving, living universe that even when we didn't have it early on, we can find our way to. So in True Refuge and in my own work with myself and other people, I'm usually looking for where is there some tendril of knowing about that loving voice that we can bring to our attention and actually strengthen. And I think one of the powerful potentials in meditation is to build those kind of resources. And so, for example, with one woman I was working with that was traumatized, her mother was completely absent when she was violated by her father. So her mother was not the source, but she was able to bring to mind a few other people in her life, and I was one of them, and imagine us standing around her. And when she'd imagine it, she'd actually, it was very kinesthetic, actually feel, just as an infant would, a kind of sense of being held, like she felt like she was in a warm bath. And she'd remember that over and over again in her mind. it didn't matter if we were actually there until it's almost like she was developing the neural pathways back to that experience that you're describing that would be more available to her. So then when trauma came up, she actually had that sense of a loving container to kind of hold her as the fear arose.
And what I would suggest, Tara, what happened there was that loving container didn't create anything inside of her. It awakened something that was already there. I believe with very, very few exceptions, we're born with the capacity to experience love and awe and gratitude and trust. I don't think babies could survive without that, those abilities.
I completely am with you. And my sense is it's intrinsic and we're reawakening it or remembering, but we've been kind of temporarily cut off in terms of our consciousness, and this is a way of reconnecting with something that's there.
Yeah, it's interesting, that language. I just heard you, remembering. It's almost as though there's a member that has been disconnected, a member of our beings, our psyche, and almost
which is actually what trauma does. I mean, we now know that trauma literally, there's a kind of a severing of the communication between the limbic system and the frontal cortex, and in a way we're reestablishing the communication to our back to our wholeness again.
Let's take a minute here, Tara, and talk about trauma and what it does to us. I mean, you gave us a very biological explanation. And we did a show a couple of weeks ago on things that come out of nowhere at us. And just pull the ground from under us, and we find ourselves in free fall. You began your book talking about your health and your body when you discovered you had a genetic disease that affects the connective tissue of your body disconnecting from itself. I wonder when that started and what impact it had.
Well, thank you for bringing it in, because it's actually on my mind just now as we were speaking that this was about 8 years ago when I got a diagnosis of having the premutation of Fragile X, which meant loose connective tissue, which means my body doesn't hold together so well and I can easily injure. And it was traumatizing in a sense, because so much of my joy and aliveness and feeling of belonging to the earth has to do with moving around freely. And so my first reactions were a kind of a traumatic reaction of really the ground shook from under me, fear and grieving and anger. I mean, every possible emotion. It actually became what motivated me to write the book, because I realized in the midst of this huge urge to feel the connection to life no matter what. In other words, in the midst of living and dying, to still feel my love for moment-to-moment experience. Well, and it, much as you described in that beautiful poem, that real appreciation of whatever's happening right here. So it deepened my dedication to find, here's this trauma, how do I find refuge in the midst of this? And it really had to do with connecting. How do I, even when I'm not connected in some ways, feel the deepest level of connection?
What happened to you physically, Tara?
I started injuring myself, so I could no longer, when I was very into physical activity, I could no longer hike up a hill. I mean, had to stop running, had to stop biking, couldn't swim. It reached its peak when friends drove off to swim in the ocean, and I couldn't go because I couldn't even walk on the beach anymore. The sand was too difficult. Since then, I've recovered some more level of capacity, but still much different than I used to be. But that was it. I was losing mobility in many ways.
So your life now is, like life in general, pretty unpredictable.
That's the whole thing. It's that I had to face another level of the truth that's completely uncertain, that the given is it'll all happen. Everything gets taken away. And when we really get that, and I mean get that in a visceral way, it's both, you know, shatters our world, and it also gives us the possibility of discovering something larger, something deeper, something more timeless that we can rest in. In fact, we don't have the possibility of discovering a deeper level of freedom until we get real with the fact that it's all going.
Yes, Sartre said, talked about living with death on your shoulder, and I often do, but I find that when I have death on one shoulder, and I find that I have life on the other, and
absolutely,
that's when everything's palpable. Yeah,
that's the deal. In fact, you cannot live fully unless you realize that it's all moving, changing, going.
Well,
and then you actually are freed to live fully.
Well, let me add something else. All this sounds great, but you talked about the trance before. I don't think you can live without going in and out of trance either.
I can just, for myself, say what I witness is that we do go in and out of trance. I don't know what's possible, except that I'd say that for many, many people, the trance is getting more thin, more transparent, so that there are more and more moments of a kind of remembering that, okay, so this is going on, I'm in this role, yes, there's some striving to succeed in certain ways, but there's something in the background that's bearing witness that's larger than that kind of persona and then the larger than the pursuit.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Anne on the line. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm calling because when I heard you, I heard you advertising the program, and it was almost like do you have a fear of something? Do you turn to others or do you turn within? And that hit it for me because I've been turning to others, and I have this fear of tackling what is approaching hoarding piles. Avoiding it. I mean, it's in every room, and people would say, "Well, you're not a hoarder," but I can't go through. You know what it's doing each time I attempt to go through a section. Confusion sets in, and I turn away, and then it turns into a snowball effect, and the guilt sets in because I'm not doing it because it's not pleasurable for me. It's a waste of time and money because I can't find things that I need to use, and it's not fair to the other people in my house.
And is that the goal? You said it's not pleasurable. Is that what you're after here?
Pleasure? I'm after more order in my life.
How come?
Because I'm not able to accomplish. I waste a lot of time looking for things. It's gone to a level that I can't handle.
And
that's, hoarding is an issue that I've tried to go to therapy, but it seems there's very few people that in my area that deal with that subject.
All right, I just want to clarify something before we turn to Tara for the ultimate wisdom here.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear the pressure I just put on you.
Yeah.
All right. So when you talked about, you know, guilt, I hear guilt and I hear judgment and all that stuff is part of the narrative you tell yourself, right? I am, I do, I've got this label, I need this therapy, right? That's all part of the narrative. What I'm not hearing is what goes on below your neck. What are the emotions? What are the bodily sensations you feel?
When I try and then can't, well, even when I try, I get, my heartbeat pounds more.
Okay.
I feel shaky. It's anxiety.
You feel anxiety?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Most
right.
definitely.
Okay. And is that the driving emotion?
Is that the driving emotion of why I want to... Oh, is that the driving emotion I feel after I attempt?
Before, during, or after? Is that the emotion that is in the driver's seat of your life here?
I think it is.
Okay. Okay. So, Tara?
So, Anne, this is a bit of a continued inquiry. I'm curious when that comes up for you, when the anxiety comes up. Do you spend some time with it? How do you work with it?
How do I find anything within myself? I think the first thing I said in the beginning of this conversation was that it hit me when Dan said, do you turn to others? Do you always turn to others? And that's what I find myself doing. I'm looking for help outside of myself, but I'm really the only one that can work through this.
So let me make sure I understand that when you get that, when that fear comes up, you turn to others. Rather than spending time with your own experience at that moment.
Exactly.
What would happen if, let's say, when you attempt to start going through piles, you attempt to address the hoarding and make some order of things, and the anxiety came up, what would happen if you said to yourself, okay, I'm going to... experience this fear right now and just start hanging out with the anxiety? And if even right now, are you aware of anxiety as you even think about this or talk about this?
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And just a simple question. If you could talk to the place in you that's anxious and say, well, how do you want me to be with you?
How do you want me to be with you?
Yeah, how do you want me to be with you?
I could ask a similar question, but a bit different. When you decided to pick up the phone and call here today, what did you want?
I know what I wanted was...
Don't go so fast. Wait a minute.
Okay.
Don't go so fast. I know what your head wanted. Your head wanted information. What did your heart want? What did you really want when you called the show? Don't be realistic.
Don't be realistic.
No, I've got no time for reality.
I don't think I wanted attention, but my heart wanted really to know if there was a way that I could find within myself so that I could, as Tara said, sit there with my anxiety and ask. That's a different way of looking at it.
Well,
how should I deal with this?
Here's why I asked this question.
Mm-hmm.
Because you put so much on yourself with these judgments and these shoulds, and now you're saying I should look inside myself. And, you know, you say you look to others, but what do you look to others for? You know, when I look to others, I look for understanding, kindness, compassion. I look to be held and loved for who I am, crazy and all.
That's
what I look to others for.
Mm-hmm.
And when I utter the simple words, and I do it often, I feel crazy right now. Please hold me. I'm usually able to drop my shoulders and take a deep breath.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm bringing that up is because of just what Tara said early in the show, that it's got to start with relationships. If you don't have that grounding underneath in your history, it's got to start with relationships. Healthy relationships, safe relationships, loving relationships. That's where it starts. All right?
I would just add that that is completely essential, and you don't have to wait to to begin to offer inwardly some attention to what's coming up, to listen to what it wants and needs, because it'll bring you to the same place. If you just pause when you, next time you get anxious, and I really believe in pausing, just pause. And there's what is sometimes called the two wings of attention. And the first wing is just to speak to the anxiety and say, okay, so what's happening in here? Just give it, let it express itself, and sense, like, what does it really need from you in that moment? Because what it most might need, and you can sense for yourself, like, what does that anxious place need from you? What comes up for you?
I think they're great questions, and I love where we've left this. And I do wish you the best, and I'm grateful to you for calling in and being as open as you were. I think it was helpful for everyone, all our listeners. Thanks so much. Tara, unfortunately, we've got to take a short break. We're going to be back in 60 seconds. We're talking about refuge, where it is in our lives, what we search for and how we search for it. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. University of the Sciences accepts transfer students into its undergraduate degree programs and offers convenient evening office hours to help students with their questions and learn about the admission process. Students can also find out about starting or furthering their career in pharmacy, chemistry, healthcare business, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and more. More online at usciences.edu/transfer.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Tara Brack about her new book, True Refuge, Finding Peace and Freedom in Your Own Awakened Heart. And we're talking about refuge, what it means, where we find it, and what the experience of refuge is. Tara, let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Jesse. We've got Jesse on line one. Hi, Jesse. Jesse? Okay. We've got a technical glitch. I wonder, there's a great deal of research out now, about the parallels between physical and emotional pain. Do you think the suffering in your body awakened you to what your heart really needed? I know mine did. It took years.
You know, suffering in the body, when it's in the body, it's pain. And for me, it was physical pain, but it was really the emotional pain of feeling a sense of loss and helplessness and powerlessness that I felt in my body. It wasn't like just an idea that deepened my commitment. And what I found was the portal to healing was being able to stay in my body and feel what was there.
You talk about forgiveness throughout the book. How does that help us find our way to that refuge you talk about?
The block to refuge is blame. That adds a layer that I think locks the prison door. So, like for myself, it's very easy for me to go into, well, I'm overworking, I'm overdoing, you know, it's my fault that I'm this way, you know. I can blame myself for feeling terrible. We call it the second arrow. You already feel bad and then you blame yourself because you blew it and you deserved it or whatever. So self-forgiveness and self-compassion, I think of as the key juncture, really, in the whole healing process. Because most of the time, being at war with ourselves is what is preventing us from finding refuge. And when I worked, I'm thinking right now of one man I worked with who, lot of problems with anger and hurt people he loved with his anger, lashing out and so on. And he right before he came to retreat, he had just really hurt his wife in a way. She had just had a biopsy, and rather than asking her the results of the biopsy, he blew up at her for not, mailing something for him. He had forgotten. So he came to retreat hating himself, Dan. And this was, so he thought he was on a path to true refuge. He just hated himself. And it wasn't until in a meditation he could see that his father had the same temper, remember his father out of control, his father begging someone, saying, "It's not my fault, I can't help it." And he realized, it's not my fault. And that was like this key juncture, not that he was irresponsible, that he couldn't be able to respond, but that the conditioning is so deep in us to whatever it is we're blaming ourselves for, that if we can't in some way get that, it's not like we're choosing that this happened, we're caught. That compassion can free us up to actually then act in ways that are a lot more intelligent. Well, so I consider self-forgiveness as key.
I understand self-forgiveness, but he did hurt someone. Where does responsibility fit in this?
I've found for people that when they don't hate themselves and blame themselves, they actually have the capacity to be more responsible. That the self-blame actually creates a kind of inner state of unpleasantness and aversion that triggers off the next round of the very behavior that we hate. So, for instance, with an addictive behavior where we're hurting ourselves, being ashamed of the binge eating really triggers the next round of binge eating. And it's the same thing with anger. So one of the metaphors that helps me a lot, Dan, is of a dog in the woods, and the person goes up to them to pet it, and the dog lurches out, its fangs bare, and the person feels angry and upset, and the next thing they realize is that dog's leg was in a trap underneath the leaves, and then they shift from anger to, "Oh, you poor thing." Well, when we act in addictive ways, in angry ways, in ways that are harmful, our leg's in a trap. It's not when we're happy or at peace or content or awake that the behavior comes out like that. And if we can recognize our leg's in a trap, we can attend to the trap. We can actually attend to the self-healing process in a way that enables us to be more responsible in the future.
So that when we hurt someone, then what's going on underneath is we are suffering. And
we are suffering. We only create suffering when we're suffering. And if we pay attention to the suffering, rather than adding another layer of suffering, which is self-aversion, we actually can start moving towards healing.
Let's go back.
And for this man, just to say, just the words, "It's not your fault," that actually softened and opened his heart in a way that he radically shifted in terms of he started being able to watch his anger in a way, and that pause where he could pause and say, "Wait a minute, I don't have to go in this direction." That became possible because there was more self-compassion.
Yeah, I tell you, when I listen to that story and I try to feel my way into that man's experience, all I want to do is cry. Just cry for what I've done, cry for the person I love, cry for myself, that there's just been so much suffering going on, just tears underneath all of that.
The tears really bring, open the way to bringing healing to others.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tears, like I said in the opening, tears can be self-soothing. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Jesse on the line. Hi, Jesse.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay.
Yeah, I hear the shrug in that. I heard your shoulder shrug when you said you were okay.
You have good ears. I was going to ask and comment. I didn't seem to have any type of anxiety through most of my life until about a year after my father passed. He passed very suddenly, and that's when I began getting panic attacks, and they were always, they weren't of the nature of, like, social anxiety. It was pretty much every single time it was my body tightening up and tensing, and then me feeling like I was going to have a heart attack or a stroke. So this was always really rough. The fact that he died suddenly didn't help. But my question is, where would refuge be on that when it's essentially my own body that's giving me such a fear? And my father, who was a very calming presence, it was the loss of him that actually started this ball rolling.
Tara?
So you lost a calming presence, and then your body started feeling the sense of that kind of traumatic, panicky fear. And I guess a question that I'd be curious about, Jesse, is there anything that you have found subsequently that does soothe? I mean, what are you finding that does help in any way?
Well, I've done a lot of things. I did therapy for a while. That was okay, but then I lost my health insurance, so that really doesn't help. I've been looking up a lot of meditation, progressive muscle relaxation, a lot of things that have definitely helped. But then you'll have, like, a day like today. I told your producer when I called in, I was actually having a very rough time today. It felt like I wasn't getting any air, and my throat was really tight. This is despite the fact that I'm, you know, it's pretty much no matter what I do, it's still always there in some fashion. And the thing I've heard is, oh, take your mind off it, it'll go away. And that really, really does not work for me.
No, it sure
does. I'm just curious if it makes a difference if you're with other people that you consider to be caring, accepting, good beings, or does that make a difference? Do you have those attacks?
They definitely come on less, but at the same time, I've still had, you know, I've been in a room with the people I trust most in life and been just as bad. It's really hard to get a grip on this when it really seems to be such a random occurrence. Like, I accept now at this point that it is anxiety and stress causing this, but even once I've accepted that and done my work towards that, it has such a random quality of just coming up out of nowhere.
Jesse, I don't know if you heard the beginning of our show, but we talked about Tara's connective tissue disease, and those symptoms also come out of nowhere, just like my symptoms in my body. And, you know, my neurotic insecurity also comes out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the question I bring up is, how do we cope with things that come out of nowhere? Tara, could you summarize what you said in the beginning of the show?
Sometimes when we don't have other people around and we're not in the middle of therapy, then the inquiry and the invitation is there a way that we can relate to what's coming up in the moment that is self-comforting? I mean, that's the whole inquiry. And for you, because it seems like me and like Dan, there's something to do with connection, like feeling connected to, like your connection was just really pulled, you know. It's like, how do you come back to feeling connection? And I'll just share with you what I do, Jesse, often is I literally will put my hand on my heart and I will think of the person or people or situations where I feel most comforted. And for you, I don't know what happens when you think of your father in the times that he was a really comforting presence and just sense that, in a way, you're calling on that energy and letting it flow through your heart, through your hand, into your heart. But it's an experiment. that's one of many experiments to find out what helps you bring you back when trauma has kind of cut you off from that connection. What helps to reconnect?
I also wonder, and Jesse, thanks so much for your call, but I also wonder when this kind of anxiety comes up in the wake of death, I wonder, if we have fully said goodbye and what that means, and are there many more tears of grief lurking behind all of that anxiety? The other thing I wondered with Jesse and with all of us who experience trauma is suddenly out of nowhere we lose a father, and that makes us feel so much more fragile in this life. That's a scary feeling when we first awaken to our own fragility. Has that been your experience?
Well, are you talking to me or Jesse?
You. Jesse's gone.
Okay. That is the core of it, Dan, for me. I mean, it kind of brings us back to the starting place. The way it's been described, William James said, the cry at the beginning of every religion is help.
Yeah.
That we get existentially that this is all very, very uncertain. And so sensing our pathways to connection are what give us the freedom to live it fully.
Well, I think that is a wonderful note to end on, back to the beginning. And that statement is just a beautiful, elegant way of closing this show. Thank you so much for joining us, Tara. She's the author of True Refuge. Next week, we're going to be talking about grit as a key to successful children. Well, comment on the show. We're at whyy.org/voices, and you can download our show there or on iTunes. Email me at drdangottlieb.com, and hey, follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn, she's our producer. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.